because this might be the inner chronicle of what we are, and we have to articulate ourselves, otherwise we would be cows in the field.
Do you want to introduce this one?
No.
Okay. Hey, everyone. Welcome to Cows in the Field. This is a movie podcast inspired by the jungle-crazed musings of Werner Herzog. You notice I went with jungle that time.
Because we're going to the jungle.
It's on point. We're going to the jungle. My name is Justin.
I'm Laura.
And today we're talking about, if you didn't know it already, we're talking about the 1997 classic.
Question mark.
The 1997 Brendan Fraser-led kids movie. George of the Jungle.
It's like your favorite kids movie based off of a cartoon you've never seen.
Mm.
Although I realized now that, because I was Googling it, that there's a reboot of the George of the Jungle cartoon.
Right. So a lot of kids might have seen that one.
That one they have seen, but the 67 era or whatever that ran for 17 episodes.
I mean, I had seen that one.
You have?
Yes, I had seen that one. That's why I was familiar with it in the song.
Okay. Yeah, I feel like everybody knows the song and maybe has never seen a frame of the original cartoon.
Yeah.
The song is catchy.
I like the song. I've been singing it like for the last couple of days.
You have. It has not been annoying at all.
George of the Jungle, strong as he can be. Ah, watch out for that tree.
I'm not going to sing it on mic. let me just do the three leads. I mean, it's kind of two leads and a kind of supporting, but
an antagonist.
You have Brendan Fraser as George. He lives in a jungle. Actually, there's four, really. Leslie Mann as Ursula.
Stanhope.
Okay. We're going to get to her character soon. Mm-hmm. And Thomas Hayden Church as Lyle Van de Groot. Is the antagonist.
That's a great name.
I know, it's a great name. But actually, the character I wanted to mention was John Cleese, who gives the voice as Ape named Ape.
Mm-hmm.
That's just classic humor right there. I mean, that's straight out of the cartoon.
Yes.
It's like they announce it in the intro.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, good stuff. I just want to start really quickly to mention, you know, this is a kids movie, obviously. We don't do many kids movies on this podcast.
Serious people. Yeah.
But we're doing this Fraser miniseries. Neither of us had seen this movie, and we were like, let's give it a try. Let's see. I mean, I had heard people speaking effusively about this movie because it was a part of their childhood, and I thought, all right. You know, I think it was ultimately worse than I expected. That said, there's interesting things going on and we're going to talk about that.
We still have stuff to say.
I don't want to, you know, be a downer to anyone who's listening for whom this movie, you know, is an important movie for them. Look, I like a lot of stupid movies, and I think it's part of being a film lover to love a few stupid movies. You have to love a few stupid movies, and you have to be just like, yeah, I like it. No apologies. That's me. If that's you for this movie, by all means. This movie for me, though, we were rewatching some scenes right before recording, and I had literally forgotten that they had happened. And I watched this movie like a day ago. I mean, I was like, wait, that happened in this movie? Just sequences of guys getting hit in the nuts and like faces going into, you know, elephant turds and fart jokes thrown in there randomly. I was like, oh, wow. I literally have no visual memory of that happening. And so there we go. I mean, I obviously...
Thomas Hayden Church falls in an elephant turd like an absolute pro.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, that's one thing we're going to talk about. This movie really contains some committed performances.
Oh,
and
yeah.
That's what makes it, I think, you know, that redeems it to some extent. That said, it's a very silly movie. You, as a listener, may have never seen it and may never want to see it. And that's fine. You should still listen to the episode. Who cares? You're probably never going to watch this movie. If you have seen it and you love it, we're not going to really dunk on it anymore. That's it. We got it out of our systems. Now we're just going to...
I wasn't going to dunk on it at all. Yeah. I didn't even need this preamble.
All right. I feel like I have like a little bit of defensiveness where it's like, I don't want people to get the wrong impression that I really like this movie.
Okay, calm down.
So,
all right.
Okay.
10 second pitch?
Yeah, let's start with the 10 second pitch. Laura, do you want to pitch our audience on why they should watch this movie?
I mean, I think my 10-second pitch is, if you have a nostalgia for 90s era movies that are filled with animals that talk and it's not CGI, and I personally do have a bit of a nostalgia for that. Like, I'm thinking like Babe and Beethoven and Dr. Doolittle, not the 2019 one, which is a whole lot of CGI. I kind of have like a weird, like, my childhood was filled with a lot of live action movies with animals that kind of like jerkily move their heads while we've got some voiceover happening. There is a little bit of CGI in this movie, but a lot of animals, and it's funny. Mixed in with some animal suits. I guess we'll talk about that.
That's part. That's the best stuff.
That's the best stuff. But yeah, it hit a little nostalgia chord for that reason for me.
Here's my pitch.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I just think Brendan Fraser is like so committed in this performance. It's kind of like a joy to watch. That is why I would pitch like watching that versus Dr. Doolittle.
Okay. That's fair. Yeah. So my pitch is that I'm going to do it the way you normally do it, Laura. So are you a 10-year-old heterosexual girl who's looking to have a sexual awakening?
I'm nodding vigorously.
While watching a greased up, muscular Brendan Fraser swing between trees and flash a giant toothy grin and look generally doe-eyed and confused, then this is the movie for you.
Okay. That pitch seemed snarky. But
no, let me ask you this. So this movie passed you by on your, when you were 10 or whatever.
I guess so. I don't know if I've seen it or not. Much like you, maybe it went through my mind like a sieve because my mom, I mentioned to my mom we were recording this today and she's like, ugh, I don't like that movie. And I was like, so we have seen it, because I'm sure my mom didn't see it on her own. maybe my sister saw it with my mom and I wasn't involved. But I do have I had some recollection as we were watching the movie of having seen it.
But it didn't leave an impression on you. That's
no, it wasn't like on heavy rotation a la Mummy.
Yeah, well, because like 2 years later, you have a sexual awakening watching the Mummy. Yeah. But it's interesting to me because Brendan Fraser is so much more sexualized in this movie.
Yeah, but I don't...
He's basically naked almost the entire movie.
Except for that he's also like a baby. Up. Like body-wise, he's sexualized. Mind-wise, not so much.
Yeah, but we're going to get to that.
I don't know. I don't know why it passed me by. Honestly, it might have been the fart stuff. I think I was like, I'm too adult for this.
Okay.
I don't like farts. Cut to me as a mom of a toddler, and all we do is talk about farts.
Well, let's start there. So I don't know what women want. So that's why I have you on this to help me out here. So what do women want? Do they want someone like George, who's a foolish, attractive hero? Or do they want someone who has a kind of intelligence, who's cunning and conniving, like Lyle?
I keep thinking about the line that Ursula says when all the women are lined up watching him with the horse.
Exactly.
And they're just like, oh my God. And Ursula is like, what did she say? She goes, he taught me how to swing and fed me cream of coconut. And her little Ursula voice and her little Leslie Mann voice. And I think, the things that are attractive about George are not as that his lack of intelligence so much as like the adventure that he promises and that he has a nurturing side, which I think men don't always think women want. But in fact, I think that's like one of the most appealing things about Lyle.
All right, give me some examples. You mean George?
It's George, I do.
Give me some examples of his nurturing side.
Well, he fed her coconut cream. all he does is listen to animals' problems and try and solve them for them.
I see.
He's a good listener, even when you're talking monkey, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, okay. Man. He's good. Okay, so that's what he does.
Yeah,
like he goes around and solves animal problems. So he's like a vet. That's what women want, a vet.
No, he doesn't solve their intestinal problems, or maybe he does.
He solves their emotional crises.
He solves their emotional crises. If you are a monkey and you're being picked on, guess who's going to help you out? George.
I see. He sticks up for the little guy. I mean,
he does.
But he is also foolish. And I do wonder if that's part of the appeal, because she gets to sort of dress him and she gets to teach him about the ways of the world. And
although maybe she should have let him wear that dress, because he wore the hell out of that dress, is all I'm saying. And maybe if her as the narrator points out, she wasn't so conservative about gender norms. She could have let George decide if he wants a dress or pants. Because the dress is a lot more butt flap like, and I think he would have been more comfortable.
That's true. He did like the butt flap.
Well, I mean, listen, if her model for what kind of husband partner you want in life is her mom and her dad, it does kind of seem like her mom is the boss of that relationship and her dad just kind of goes along with the flow. Mm-hmm. And George is very good at going with the flow.
Yeah.
Ursula can set the agenda when there's when George is her partner.
That's right.
And Lyle was not going to let that happen. And I think maybe she seems like a little bit of a pushover in the beginning of the movie, but I don't think she is. I don't think Ursula is. I think Ursula knows what she wants. And maybe what she wants is somebody who's a little more easygoing and maybe a little dumber. Maybe. Lyle seemed dumb too, honestly.
Yeah, fair enough. He was more controlling though. You're right.
He was more controlling. Yeah.
I mean,
I don't think we should be focusing on intellect here, although I guess that is.
Well, it plays a part of it's a really important part of his characterization that he's, you know, it's not just that he doesn't speak English correctly and he doesn't know whatever. He doesn't understand like the ways of modern society. He doesn't seem to understand how to learn from his experience.
Right. That's the problem. Trees.
The trees seem to be a
right.
Because
I was just about to make an argument that he's not stupid. He's ignorant. And
I think it's more than that.
But you think it's more than that? Because he did run into a lot of trees.
The ignorance is part of it. And that's part of what kind of characterizes him as a foolish character. But I think it's also the running into the burning building.
Yeah.
Right. To just
well,
to quote
Tenet. You don't
Tenet,
know if you're going to run into the burning building.
That's
you
right.
never know that about yourself.
George knows. That's the thing.
Because he's done it like six times.
He's dumb. He's done it, been burned on most of his body multiple times, and he just keeps
and
going
says, George
back
burned
in.
And then does it again.
That's the thing. And so I was thinking like about this character, and part of the appeal might be the fact that he is, I think, really a heroic fool. And I was thinking about whether there are any heroic fools in, you know, as a like an archetype of a character in literature. And there really aren't that many examples of it. Typically in literature, there's like the fool archetype and the hero archetype. And oftentimes the fool will like grow into the hero. So that's like the Percival story in the Arthurian legends. But they're often contrasted with one another. And I think part of the reason they're contrasted with one another is that the fool archetype is sort of portrayed as like this nihilist who just kind of stands above the fray, doesn't buy into the conflict. He just kind of stands above and comments sardonically on things. But he kind of is portrayed as foolish in the sense that like people see him as foolish or whatever by not partaking in the conflict. But the other thing is that, so he kind of can't be heroic in some sense because he's amoral. Yeah. He doesn't buy into that situation. But the other reason I think that these things are often conflicting is that the hero is typically like a protagonist character. It's a viewpoint character. People want to identify with the hero. They don't really want to identify with the fool, right? Nobody wants to think of themselves as foolish. And so I think that contributes, I think, to a certain extent to why this, you don't see hero fools that much, right? Mm.
I mean, would you consider Forrest Gump a heroic fool? Or do you think that's not quite the right word to apply to Forrest Gump?
Definitely fool, it works. I mean, hero, you're right. He does do heroic things. Yeah, he does. And he does them for confused reasons. So Forrest Gump is actually, that's right. That's a good example. I was trying to find examples like further back.
Oh,
but like when you go in like Shakespeare,
you were like Odysseus.
Yeah, but no, yeah, when you go into like Shakespeare and you just don't see them really.
Right. Because there's a Puck character who's not really a fool, but he's more like an imp, I guess. He's not.
There's like mischievous characters,
mischievous,
right? But
yeah,
fools
yeah.
are like jesters and stuff, and they're there for like levity, but they're not.
Bottom
and often
is the fool in that in
okay,
Midsummer,
yeah.
not a Puck. Yeah,
but
okay.
that's the thing is, but you're right that like yeah, maybe modern film and TV and stuff, there are more instances of this. But I did stuff out of them as interesting. But in this movie and this, in the movie, because I don't think the TV show does this, they kind of get around that by actually making George not the protagonist
yes.
of the film. Ursula is the protagonist of the film. She's the character we meet first. She's the viewpoint character. She's the character with a real conflict and an arc. George has basically no arc. And the only conflict that George has is all filtered through Ursula's problems.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought that was interesting that that's how they kind of get around this issue. Because if George was the main character, maybe the audience wouldn't be able to get into it because they're like, oh, this guy's a moron. Like, I can't identify with this character. But if you just identify with yourself as Ursula, as like someone who's obviously attracted to this guy for various reasons, and he's the solution to her problems, that's a different, you know, that's a different story. And that's one that can play for audiences more easily.
Yeah, no, it's this really smart move. And I did look up whether or not Ursula has a backstory in the cartoon. And I did not go through the research of watching 17 episodes. So, you know, people can tweet at us if they find out otherwise. But I could not find anything about Ursula and George the Jungle in the original cartoon. It just seems like she was just hot wife with big boobs. There's absolutely no background on how she got there and why she's also living with monkeys. So I think it was really smart of the writers and producers of this movie to be like, to think about this from Ursula's point of view.
Mm-hmm. And that brings us to, like, the central conflict of the movie, which is Ursula doesn't want to marry Lyle.
Mm-mm.
But her mom wants her to marry Lyle. She's an heiress, so she's rich. She lives in a particular type of, you know, society, and she has all this, all the trappings of that society. And Lyle's a good match in that regard. She's effectively been matched up with him by her mother.
Mm-hmm.
He comes from the right pedigree and all that. But she's an adventurer, right? We meet her on a safari. She's out, you know, exploring Africa. And she wants an adventure. She doesn't want to stay at home in her wonderful San Francisco apartment in the comfort of her.
Listen, at least they explain that wonderful car. It's not like she's like a line cook and lives in that apartment, you know, a la mini TV show.
Yeah, sure. No, I'm just saying that who would make such a choice anyway?
Lots of people, Justin. You just don't like leaving the house.
Yeah. She wants to go out to the world and see the jungle and go on an adventure. George provides that adventure. Lyle is like the, you know, he's the anchor that's holding her down. So her conflict is to figure out how she can break it to her parents, ultimately, that she does not want to marry Lyle and wants to be with George. That's the central conflict of the movie. Now, for a kid's movie, it's not immediately clear. Like, is this like a standard? Does this happen in kids' movies? I feel like this is kind of an adult theme. You know, like, would kids 6, 7, 8, 9, 10-year-olds,
mm-hmm.
like, once you're a teen, you're not watching this movie. You're gonna be rolling your eyes. But it's only when you're a teen when you start to date other people who your parents might not like.
You're so stupid. Have you ever seen a Disney princess movie? My man. What do you think Aladdin is about? Jasmine doesn't want to be a princess anymore. And and at one point is almost forced to marry Jafar, but she wants to be with a peasant named Aladdin.
They always do this. Everyone's always doing this.
Ariel, you know, is a princess, and she doesn't want to marry other sea princes because she wants to be a human and marry Eric, who's also a prince, okay, but a land prince.
I'm very confused by this because these movies are made for like four-year-olds.
You're so stupid. All what little girls do is play marriage all day long. Do you know how many times I married Raggedy Andy? Like, a lot.
But I don't understand. Okay, this is vexing to me. You're right, first of all, that yes, all these Disney movies are about
matchmaking and like being forced, but your parents want you to marry one person and then you decide to marry another one.
All right. I point taken on that. I clearly have not seen many of these movies. I remain confused why these movies would appeal to 4 and 5 year olds.
I don't think it's for 4 and 5 year olds. I think it's for like 8, 9, 10 year olds.
Come on, really?
There's too many farts in it.
If I was 8 or 9, I think so. I think I would have been like, this is fucking stupid.
All right, point taken.
I think this is for young kids, right?
I think it's for all quadrants.
All quadrants.
I think they were just 25-year-old adults going to see this on a date. Sorry, I'm kidding.
Okay, but like, even if you're eight, mm-hmm. you're not like dating people. You don't have like sexual desire, really.
No, but
so like,
but the
what's going
the
on?
Story about like for. I feel like as a little girl, and maybe this was like...
You are not a little girl. Let's be clear.
When you're I was a little okay, girl, yeah. Let me fucking finish. when I was a little girl, and maybe this was sort of like self-perpetuated because of the Disney movies that I was watching constantly, but I feel like the narrative of marriage and who I was going to partner with was like very, very, very deeply into my DNA and my like understanding what my future would be. And it felt like an immediate future, even though, of course, it's not going to be for another 20 plus years.
I see, but this was a non-sexualized future. It was just like,
yes,
this is what it's like, as what your career will be.
Uh-huh.
It will be marrying Lyle DeGroot.
Yes, exactly.
I see.
Exactly. There was way more focus on that than there was in like what I was going to do with my life.
I see. So you think this is a movie pitched to 6 to 9 year old girls in particular?
Because no, boys are there too because they like farts.
Yes, but the central conflict of
and
the movie.
And monkeys are funny.
Boys don't look. Boys, this is too much gender stuff. But
no.
We're
painting in really broad strokes and what culture is telling gendered kids to care about.
But my experience as a boy growing up was princess stories. I did not like that. Right, I was just like, no, I was like anti that, and that's what I was taught in some sense by culture, via like the people I hung out with and all that. So I was thinking, so I would not, if I go to this movie thinking it's going to be a cool jungle guy, but it's really about what guy this girl wants to marry. This is basically a princess story. Then I'm like, I'm not into it, right? Mm-hmm. So I was thinking this movie is in 1997 pitched to young girls, right?
Yeah, maybe. And I think they were probably trying to have it both ways, you know, like Aladdin, where, you know, if you're watching that as a little...
Well, that's Aladdin's different because it's Aladdin's story. The
right.
name of the movie is Aladdin. Well, I guess the name of the movie is fucking George of the Jungle. But it's Aladdin's story about coming out of poverty and aspiring to whatever.
But maybe what we're...
I haven't seen Aladdin in like 40 years.
Yeah, Justin is 67 years old. Well, I think what maybe as adults watching George of the Jungle, the only part that we found the part that we found most compelling was Ursula's arc.
Yeah.
But you're not maybe as concerned about arc as a kid. And so maybe what you find most compelling is the monkey stuff, the adventure stuff, you think it's funny when what the parts where Lyle's just sort of like being made fun of in Swahili all the time.
All right, fine. Yeah.
There's a lot of other parts of this movie besides Ursula's story. It is true that Ursula has the only arc.
Yes. That's what I mean. It's like she, you know, with Aladdin, there's some kind of like, there's multiple narratives happening. And with a lot of those movies,
Aladdin might knight be a better a written movie.
No. I'm not, look, no judgment. I'm just saying, who is this movie pitched for?
Yeah.
Like, when it's a knight and a princess, there's their princess's side, whatever. She's trapped in a tower. She wants to get out. Then there's also the knight side. Like, he's got to, you know, overcome some issues in order to prove his valor or some crap.
Mm-hmm.
So that, but it's just, there's no knight side with George of the Jungle. He doesn't, like, Ursula, he likes Ursula, sure. But like, is that a conflict in the movie? Like, he wants to be with Ursula. I didn't get that vibe. I mean, yes, he wants to be with her, but I also got the vibe that like, if she was just like, yeah, I need to be with Lyle, he'd just be like, okay, I'm going to hang out with Ape again.
Yeah. I think George's stuff is just that he gets to see a wider world. But in the end, he goes back to his treehouse because that's where he's happy and he spends time with the animals. And that's, you know, but now he has a partner to do it with. But he gets to have this adventure in the city and see that there's a bigger world and see that there are other people out there, which he's never really interacted with else but like him before.
Yeah, that's right.
Obviously, isn't that, you know, compelling to him because he still wants to go back and be in the jungle. But I suppose that's the closest that we come to him having an arc.
Yeah, I guess you're right. Yeah, I mean, there's some conflict that, like, you know, he does want to protect Ursula. But to what end, it was less clear to me. But maybe if he does love her, that's it. That's enough. Maybe that's just good enough, you know? Like, it's just love. And so it's love through and through.
Doesn't have to be complicated, Justin.
It's a love story at its core. I'm fine with that.
We got to the bottom of it. Podcast over.
Yeah, I just had to figure it out.
Okay. Also, women love it when men like animals.
Yeah, so I've heard. Okay, we talked about kids. We've talked about Ursula. We talked about what women want.
Wait, I just also wanted to point out that I think it's cool that Ursula gets to save George at one point.
Yes.
She's not really, at several points in the movie, she's a damsel in distress, but I would not characterize her like I don't think overall her character is damsel in distress throughout the most of the movie. She's the one who's in control of their relationship. And she's the one, we touched on this, but then didn't really like linger on it. But she's the one who has to make a choice about who she wants to be with and the path that she wants her life to be on.
And George does nothing with
George does nothing. No. He's completely passive in that.
No, he plays no role in that. Yes. She just has to confront her parents. There's not like some scene where George is coaching her about what to say.
No. But I think it's cool that like she is not only damsel in distress, but she does get to swing in and save the day and prevent George from being shot. I also think it's really cool that she wears like her, you know, practical boots and her button-down shirts and her slacks.
Shout out to Jurassic Park. What is the new one called where she's wearing heels?
Oh, God. Yeah.
What was that one called?
I don't
Forbidden
know.
Forbidden Planet or something.
That sounds right. Yeah. That's exactly right. I think it's cool. I mean, I just think, you know, also, I think I was trying to remember curly hair had like another moment in the late 90s, right? Her hair is so gloriously curly. And I love that they let her hair be curly because we're about to get into the moment where you have to only have straight hair in the early 2000s. And that, you know, was a hard time for Laura. I really burned my hair like a lot.
Tell me a bit more about that.
Have you ever smelled burning hair? I'm just kidding.
I like all that. I mean, I think that's fair. And I want to ask a couple questions, though, about...
Oh, and she tells him she loves him. She has the big moment. I'm, you know, tell him that she loves him. He never told her.
That's true.
It's her reveal.
I mean, yeah, he doesn't really know what love is. And so that's another component where she's going to have to teach him in a way. Like, she's going to have to sort of show him how to have a relationship. She'll teach him how to be responsible and caring and these things, which he's... you know, towards another adult human being, right? He's had that relationship to animals, but...
Animals?
It turns out...
a little bit less of a complex, emotional, terrain there to navigate.
That's right. Except that, and this we're going to come to right now, which is, so he's got this friend named Ape.
Okay, we're going to talk about Ape.
Well, okay, because here's the central question that I had about this movie. I'm watching the movie and George is speaking English, and I'm thinking, okay, so like he
came out of an airplane as a baby.
I understand how human language development works. And the standard hypothesis is that if you put a baby in a jungle, a human baby in a jungle, they don't speak English. Okay? They don't speak any.
Are you sure? Because I think we should maybe send our toddler to a jungle Montessori because.
That would be detrimental to his language development. Although at this age, he probably would be fine. Weirdly. That's the crazy thing is that, you know, he probably has enough that it won't stunt his language development that much. But George, now that said, we don't know what age George was dropped in the jungle. Maybe George was dropped in the jungle at like age 5 and he had most of his life, right?
Okay. Cause he does kind of talk toddler-esque.
That actually.
Yeah.
Wow.
Does that answer your question?
Yeah, maybe.
Because I think we were thinking infant.
But okay, let's go back to infant. If he's 5, then he might have enough linguistic capacity from what he learned, you know, via his parents and all that. Okay, but let's suppose he's an infant. So how does he learn English?
From Ape.
Okay, so I love this answer because it just pushes the question back one step, which is, so now there's an ape voiced by John Cleese.
Yeah.
Who speaks English.
Yes.
So I have another question. Which is, how does Ape learn English?
From Jane Goodall.
Okay. So this is helpful because this is really answering all my questions.
I just took all that in stride. I was like, yep, nope, everything checks out.
you were like, okay, so we've got a talking ape who not only can speak English, he has glasses and he reads.
Okay. Well,
he reads English.
He's nearsighted. What's your problem?
And he was taught that by Jane Goodall.
Right. Yeah.
Okay. So that's also not how this works, but that's interesting. I'm glad you just filled in those blanks. So do you think Ape, so you're thinking your hypothesis is that the chain is Goodall to Ape.
Yeah.
To George. Here's one stick in the mud with that hypothesis. Ape speaks basically fluent English, British English.
Right.
George speaks garbage American English. That's not what you would expect if you would expect him A, to have a British accent, right? And B, to have a little bit more of a vocabulary because he learned it from this erudite British ape.
Mm-hmm.
So, one mark against your point. I suppose that the movie, yeah. So I think we got to go with he's five when he lands in the jungle.
Yeah, maybe. Because
that might do it. But again, we still don't have an explanation for how ape speaks English. Because if we assume if George taught ape how to speak English, A, ape would not speak in a British accent. And B, he wouldn't be able to freaking read. And C, he would have the vocabulary of a five-year-old.
No, I still think Jane Goodall taught.
Okay, so you're thinking Jane. Okay, that's the. Yeah.
I think that was confirmed at the end of the movie when he said,
"Madam, I knew Jane Goodall, and you are no Jane Goodall."
I think. I mean, I called it in the beginning of the movie, and I felt satisfied.
Yeah, you called your shot on that one. That's also one of the best like slams of the movie, right? Like that poetry slams. You are no Jane Goodall.
There's not a lot of like slams in this movie. There's a lot of farts and there's a lot of hitting of trees.
Right. Okay. So actually,
you want me to give the tree count?
Yeah, let's do the tree count.
Okay.
So,
in case you're curious, in the course of this film, George hits 6 trees, 1 car door, 1 boat, 1 cake/catering truck, 1 cage, and he does 1 belly flop onto the ground.
Nice.
I think that's where we're at.
Okay. That's a lot of times to learn
impact
from
your mistakes.
Okay. Here's my rope. And I see that at the end of my pendulum trajectory is a giant tree. I should probably let go of the rope before I hit the tree.
Right. Well, would it be more painful though to drop down? What if you break an ankle? Maybe the impact of your whole body is the better way to go. Have you ever been on roller skates? The only way you know how to stop is just like run right into that carpeted wall at the roller rink that smells like socks.
Yeah. Fair enough. Roller skates have brakes, but anyway. But
yeah, have you ever tried to stop using your toes and then you fall forward? It's way better to just run straight into that carpeted
wall. Okay, so when you go into the carpeted wall, do you do it like this with your hands stretched out to your sides?
Yeah,
and your
that's
arms?
How you slow your momentum.
Okay, yeah, okay.
Also, I learned how to roller skate from watching George in the Jungle.
You don't put your arms and legs in front of you to brace yourself?
You could break your arms that way.
Fair enough. Yes, you just absorb the whole.
Yeah, you want to maximize your surface
I
area.
See. Okay, that's interesting. I'm learning stuff from this one. It's interesting that he mostly runs into rubber trees. Actually, that could explain why he's not good at running into stuff. Is that he thinks everything he runs into is rubber and he'll just bounce off of it.
Oh.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's the scene where he saves somebody on the Golden Gate Bridge. No, it's the other bridge. What bridge is it?
It's the Bay Bridge.
Yeah. Bay Bridge. When he saves somebody on the Bay Bridge, they talk about how he's like calculating the angle and velocity.
Yeah.
Like they seem to suggest that he's got some sophistication in this.
Was that the actual narrator of the movie or was that the people on the TV?
That was the narrator of the
movie. Oh, the narrator. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Well, the narrator might also.
He might be unreliable.
Yeah. Or he might also be just making a joke.
Oh. So hard to tell.
I know. There is a weird meta component to this movie that doesn't work, but right where the narrator is narrating, but then they draw attention to the fact that he's narrating and that some of the characters can hear him and they speak to him.
Mm-hmm.
It is interesting though that only the bad guys speak to the narrator. The other characters don't seem to notice the narrator. So it's only
in the very opening scene, there's a distinction between awe.
Oh, that's right.
And
everyone.
H-H-H. Yes. So they are seemingly listening to the narrator in that part of the film.
Okay.
Yeah. Not clear when they're hearing the narrator and not.
Yeah. Yeah. Again, one of these things where I think if I was an 8-year-old watching this movie, I would be deeply concerned about the fact that these people can hear the voice of God constantly and nobody's like questioning it or worried about that, wondering who this person is.
You would
is.
Be deeply concerned about
yeah,
that?
Yeah, I would be concerned. I would be like, okay, so who is this person that you can all hear narrating everything in your life and you're not concerned about it?
I think that's the kind of humor that older kids love.
Older kids?
Yeah. Like that kind of that meta, like that sort of knowing winky winky kind of humor.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I think there's a lot of narrators in those kinds of movies. I mean, I don't remember how like quippy the narrator is in Babe. I don't think there's any like meta narrative parts of it. There might be though.
Yeah. I don't know. I think I haven't seen Babe in like 62 years.
I like animals in movies.
Okay.
When they cut it, like when they're wearing funny things and when they're kind of acting out. Is this the moment where you talked to me about trying to figure out when animals are real animals and when they're people?
Yes. Oh, good. Let's talk about that. So there's a several little interstitial parts of this movie where there's a bunch of apes that are in a sort of drum circle, like banging on these drums, which every time that happened, that elicited a laugh from me, I have to admit. That was a sure bet. And if they just kept cutting back to the apes, just like banging like steadfastly on those drums, that was really just
Communication system.
It's the communication system, but it also just seems, the way the apes' faces look, it feels like they're just been tasked with this job. They're just like, bang the crap out of these drums. And they're just like, they're really going for it. And so it really got me. But okay, so obviously I'm watching this movie and I'm like, those are people in ape suits.
Mm-hmm.
And I look over at Laura and you're like, man, those apes are well trained.
That is not what happened, but something very similar did happen.
So what movie was it that we were watching?
The Wizard of Oz.
Yeah. And you were what, 30 when this happened?
I was like 25.
Yeah. So you're 25 years old. You're a grown woman with a bachelor's degree.
Working on a master's.
Yeah. Well, you had a master. No, you had a master's degree at that point. Okay. Either way, you have a master's degree. Mm-hmm. You have an Ivy League education.
Yeah.
And we're watching Wizard of Oz, one of your favorite movies. You've probably seen it maybe 20, 30, 40 times, right?
Mm-hmm.
And Laura confesses to me in the scene with the flying monkeys or whatever that you thought they were trained monkeys.
When I was a kid, I thought that.
Oh, I thought you still thought it.
Well, I thought it until I rewatched it at 25. But if you'd asked me at, you know, 21. X minus one the day prior, I would have been like, they have real monkeys. Those are real monkeys. Those are just, they put them on wires, put wings on them and stuff. And then I watched the movie again.
I think you had told me that, like, you're like, yeah, and there's this cool sequence where they like train these monkeys. And I was like, well, I don't remember that. Okay, yeah. Interesting. Mm-hmm. Like, let's go back and revisit this. And then it comes to the part, and then I'm thinking, like,
those are clearly
not real monkeys. Yeah, and I look over at you, and you're like, you're looking a little bit sheepish about the bet you made.
Oh, my God. I think part of the problem is that Wizard of Oz was a movie that I was both obsessed with and terrified by, like really in my body terrified by, but also couldn't stop watching. For like four Halloweens in a row, I was different characters from Wizard of Oz. I was maybe just three. Glenda, the witch, and Dorothy.
Like, you were never the trained monkey.
No. Mm-hmm. But also when I watched it, I always had to put my covers over. I always had a blanket. Mm-hmm. I had to put the covers over my eyes whenever the witch was on screen. So that I was watching the monkeys through like a weave of a blanket.
Specifically that part, you were usually covering your eyes.
Oftentimes.
I see. Now, Fraser in this movie does a lot of stupid stuff, right? Like he has to. The character demands it. He has to play really dumb. He has to do a lot of broad physical humor, a lot of slapstick humor. And you never see on his face him doubt what he's doing. He's mm-hmm. fully committed the entire time. And this is a performance where if he had just had any doubt, any sense of self,
and any sense of his own dignity.
Of dignity or yeah, whatever. Really, you know, like, any sense of like uncomfortableness of, you know, what he's doing, it would fail because he wouldn't be committed. The audience would know it, and it'd be harder to laugh at it because you'd feel that pathos seeping through. You'd feel like, oh, this guy is actually kind of embarrassed about what he's doing. But he's not. As a result, the character's not embarrassed, Fraser's not embarrassed, and you get to just laugh along with him. He's such a fun-loving character.
Yeah.
And that is, I think, really elevates the movie. It makes it you know, it makes it a much better movie. I think there are very few actors who would be willing to go this hard on something like this.
There's a scene where Ape has told George how to seduce a woman.
Right. It's a good example.
And they're in a waterfall in a cave and they're like about to have a moment. And then all of a sudden, George starts puffing up his cheeks and throwing leaves in the air and like doing this like crazy dance and like beating his chest. All these things that we've seen Ape in a previous scene tell him to do. It's like, it's insane. And he goes so hard. He's just like, and Leslie Mann's response is also incredible. She's like maybe one of the best at sort of comedic responses. She's just like, I'm going to go get some air.
Yeah, it's good.
But that was the moment where I was like, holy crap. Like, he is all in and he's, and like, you buy it. You like get yourself lost in this movie because he's so good. I read that we talked about how good he is in Encino Man physically, but I read that his audition for Encino Man, he said it was essentially just him like wrestling a plant or something like that. So I think he does have this in him where he's just like totally willing to go for it and doesn't have any self-consciousness about it.
It's great. It really is wonderful. It's something that I feel like in like today's day and age, I mean, maybe this stuff happens. I don't know. I don't really watch kids' movies. I never really watched kids' movies ever. But I feel like it's just, I would just guess you'd see less of it. Just because with the internet and stuff, it's too easy to meme you into something, and then everyone knows that, and so everyone's like
all these freeze frames of him like puffing up his cheeks,
and then someone would put some stupid text on it and be mm-hmm. like, oh, here I am, like, you know, on the toilet or something stupid like that, and so like I feel like everyone knows that, and so there's like a self-consciousness where everyone has to be like seven layers of ironic detachment into whatever they're doing, knowing whatever's going to happen and how that's going to be received, and so it's just harder, I think. And but Fraser just doesn't give a shit. He just goes for it, and that I think is his like one of his like shining traits as an actor. I think he's done it so many times, but this is, I feel like, the most intense version of it, because it's at the script asks a lot of him and it's, he just gives it to them.
Yeah, absolutely. I was just thinking about, I just wanted to note the 2018 article about Brendan Fraser, because it talks a lot about his own self-consciousness, that in fact he did, you know, have a real struggle in Hollywood with when roles dried up and how that reflected on him. He really wanted to be Superman and that project didn't come to fruition, and how he wrestled with that. And so knowing that he's a human being and reflective and in fact self-conscious and critical of himself sometimes, it makes the fact that he went so hard at this, I think, all the more impressive.
Yeah, totally.
It's a movie. So the article is called Whatever Happened to Brendan Fraser by Zach Baron, and it's from 2018. The other thing that I want to point out is that it starts off with Brendan with his horse, which, given the fact that the sort of like Google-eyed scene of George of the Jungle is all the girls watching him prance around with a horse, is perfect, because not only is this a horse that he has because he's got a ranch in New York, I guess, you know, so what, lots of people have horses. He rescued this horse from a set. He said he looked into the horse's eyes. He said, without pretending that the animal was human, he looked at me like he needed help, like, get me out of here, man.
So he's like a real life
George. He's a real life George of the Jungle.
Wow.
To make it even more beautiful, Fraser then talks about how his oldest child is on the spectrum, and his eldest has a real connection with this horse, and the horse has a connection with his son as well. And he sort of knew that, I think, when he brought the horse home, that would be kind of like a therapeutic relationship for his son. Basically, it sounds like Brendan Fraser is like the most beautiful human, and that he does talk to animals, and he is George of the Jungle.
Amazing.
But all that, I think that like he does play these pure of heart characters, like, yes, like he's not wearing any clothes and he's got a butt flap and he does a lot of silly stuff, but what makes those characters compelling is that like heart of gold.
Yeah.
That it seems is real.
I think, no. To the person. I think 100%.
Yeah.
And I mean, we're doing this as a Frasersance because Brendan Fraser is having a bit of a renaissance at his career and everything. But it's nice to kind of go back and revisit these movies, which strangely, I mean, the movies that we're doing here are all 90s movies mostly. And they're all kind of curios of the 90s. This kind of moment of what seems now to be innocence that like has now sort of been lost to time. And it's kind of nice that like people are celebrating that kind of innocence in Brendan Fraser because he's still the same guy. And they're celebrating exactly what he was then and is now. And I'm glad to see that kind of coming back, you know, this resurgence of a kind of triumph of innocence and celebration of that, which I think is just nice to hear. Because as I was saying earlier about, you know, everything being seven layers of ironic detachment, that is, I think, at least a prevailing trend in a lot of the stuff I watch and enjoy. And it's exhausting, you know, it's mm-hmm. exhausting to constantly be engaging in 10 layers of meta reflection about what you're doing in order to subvert potential criticisms. And it's just nice to see someone go out there and be, you know, be themselves, so to speak, right? To just fully embody whatever it is they're doing without any self-consciousness. And so kudos to Fraser for doing that. I'm glad to see that his career is maybe coming back. And
he's going to be in a Scorsese movie. He's going to be in an Aronofsky movie too. Did I get that correct or not correct?
Great. Well, talk about someone who's going to be engaged in 17 layers of meta ironic reflection, maybe. You know, the other person I wanted to just draw attention to here is Thomas Hayden Church, because mm-hmm. I think his performance, for all of what we're saying about Fraser, who's amazing in this movie, Thomas Hayden Church is doing the thankless role of being unselfconsciously being a really hateable villain,
mm-hmm.
an irredeemable, hateable guy, which, you know, that's, he's in a way made a career of being smarmy, but like, I feel like I always am interested, and I kind of, not always have been, but for a long time, I've been interested in whenever there's a villain in the movie, wondering about like especially in like a kid's movie or a teen movie, like wondering about the actor, and especially if they have kids and the kids might see it, and like how they think about that role, and like how they think about like how they're going to be seen to an entire generation of people. Like, you know, like they're going to be seen as this smarmy loser, and they don't care, they just go for it, they perform the role as needed in the service of the movie. And I think that's really it's generous, right? I think it's artistically generous to basically seed the ground to Ursula, to Leslie Mann, and to Brendan. So I just want to applaud Thomas Hayden Church for what he's doing in the movie, because yeah, he brings this, and you know, for the adults in the room, he's kind of the most funny character in a lot of ways, because the adults sort of see themselves in him, right? Everything, he's like the only one he's like the only adult in the room, really, you know? And so you're sort of like,
what do you mean by that? Just because he doesn't want to be in the jungle?
Yeah, he doesn't want to be in the freaking jungle. And he takes care of stuff, right? Sure, he's an asshole.
What do you mean he takes care of stuff?
Well, like he brings the crew, right? He's got his team with him.
His weird German team when he joined a cult.
Well, he's got that team, but he's also got the British team. And
the trackers.
Yeah, he's got the trackers, and he's capitalizing on his situation. Sure, he's also an asshole. I'm not saying like adults are assholes, but I am saying like, you know, he behaves like an adult, whereas Leslie Mann behaves like a child. She behaves like a, I mean, she sounds like a child. That's part of like the Leslie Mann charm, is that she sounds like a baby, right? And of course, George to the Jungle. Well, you know, so I think like
you talk like baby.
Yeah, like I think, you know.
Yeah, I mean, the part where he's sort of dragging her for the jungle, being like, "You want to see a white ape? I'll get you a white ape. You want a latte with mocha sprinkles? I'll get you a decaf latte." That's
he's
my job.
Like the exasperated parent, right, in this situation. So, I think that's
true. You know, our son is like blue cup, and I'm like, okay, you want milk in a blue cup and not the pink cup? I'll do it in the blue cup. Like, you little psychopath.
Anyway, all right. So,
but what I don't think Ursula is a child for wanting to see a white ape. She has her
own dreams. No. But she, no, fine. But she.
She has her aspirations and he's consistently demeaning those.
Yes. But she, she is portrayed as a child. Who is she? She's child two, blah, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm.
Her whole conflict is like getting out from under her parents.
Right. Becoming her own person.
That's what I mean.
Uh-huh.
Right? She's like the young one in that sense. And he's like the adult, right? Mm-hmm. Whatever. Like, you know, obviously she's a grown woman with agency. I'm not saying that. I'm not infantilizing her. But I just think if you're an adult watching this movie, those are like the kids. And you got this guy who's dragged along, who's an asshole to everyone. Fine. But he's just feels like the adult. Anyway. So he's there to like provide comic relief mostly for the adults. I mean, and then to look stupid so that the kids can, right? So he falls in poo and stuff.
Right.
I mean,
he falls in poo. But he also like is incredibly insensitive about other cultures, which I
all that is stuff is, you know, like, of the time.
First contact has been made. No, it's not of the time. I mean, they're making fun of the way he acts. Like they're disparaging the way that he acts. Sure. It's not like... Yeah, it's not like you're like, ooh, that's something that we need to cringe at because it's the 90s.
Sure. Yeah, that's true.
That's not what's happening.
That's true. No, you're right. It's characterization of him as a bad guy.
Yes.
Nairobi Hilton. They can airlift us there in 2 hours. Pillows, okay? Wait a second. I'm losing you. Bad reception here. Okay, I've got you back. No, wait. I'm losing you. My batteries are dead. No. Duty.
But he leans into it. I don't know. So that's,
he does.
That's good.
He leans hard.
But I guess for all this, by way of saying, I want to ask you, of the three characters we just talked about, you know, who, is it Frasier for you for this movie? Like who kind of,
who
stands out for you in the movie?
Yeah. It's, I mean, I love Leslie Mann. I really do. I think, gosh, there's like this crazy movie where Zac Efron plays like a, it's like he and Matthew Perry switch bodies or something, or Matthew Perry goes back in time, whatever. Basically, Leslie Mann is the like love interest / older woman in that movie. And her responses are so incredible. I think about them all the time. She's so funny. I love her. But she's kind of doing what she always does best in this movie. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I think like if it were another person in this role, this movie would not be compelling.
Yeah.
And it wasn't my favorite movie of all time, but gosh, I think he's so good in it. It's so fun to watch him do his thing.
He's very charming. And well, I think we should also just mention that Leslie Mann, we watched an interview with her recently where she talked about how she sort of, joking, but like, I think there's like an element of seriousness just to talk about like how many layers of ironic detachment are going on in this comment. But she said she fell in love with Brendan Fraser during the making of this movie, and for all the reasons we talked about, total dedication to the role, the lack of self-consciousness, the just the genuine and earnest love of what he's doing and desire to like help people. It's all coming through. So it makes sense that that would happen.
It's so cute.
It was on what, Busy Phillips's TV show?
Yeah, Busy had a TV show, a talk show called Busy Tonight. You can find a clip on YouTube if you so wish. But yeah, she said she even, cause they brought Brendan on and she was like, remember the scene where I had to tell you I loved you, but like, I did love you. So they're speaking of layers, like, it's and Brendan handles that moment with, you know, sort of like a lot of sweetness given
poised.
The fact that of course, like she is a married woman, was a married woman at the time. Like she's pouring it on, but also it's a joke, you know, like it's kind of an uncomfortable moment
to handle
in front of an audience.
Yeah, he handles it so well.
Yeah.
Actually, that might be my favorite Brendan Fraser performance, actually. I just think because he's really poised and he jokes about it, but also is very earnest and serious and complimentary of her. And it just shows like what a genuine person he is and how he is very charismatic, really. I you know, these are coming out of order, but we had already recorded Mummy, and I kind of said a few things in the Mummy one where I was a little bit maybe down on some aspects of his performance, but I actually do think there is a real charisma there.
I think your critiques from the Mummy were more to do with the writing and the fact that it didn't totally, like, Brendan was trying to figure out how to fit himself into that character that didn't
really
work.
I think he's not perfectly cast in that role. I also think that I understand what his charisma is better, yes, weirdly, from seeing this movie than from seeing that movie.
Okay, that's
so
interesting.
If we had watched them in that order, I think I would have been more on board.
Yeah, well, and we sort of watched this movie partially just because it falls in between Encino Man and Mummy nicely, but also because apparently the casting agent for Mummy watched George of the Jungle, and they went through a bunch of other sort of the moment people in consideration, but ended up with Brendan Fraser partially because I think one of the casting agents or producers saw George of the Jungle and it convinced them that he could lead a movie. Because I think up until now, had he really led a movie?
Yeah.
So I think this is his first, but he was in School Ties with like Matt Damon and all those. And I think those names were also listed, you know, when they were trying to find a protagonist for The Mummy, right?
I want to see Matt Damon in this movie.
In The Mummy, or no, not George of the Jungle. No, George of the Mummy.
Oh, for The Mummy.
This is for The Mummy.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. But
I want to see Matt Damon in George of the Jungle. He's like, how do you like damn apples, Ursula? Sorry, that's my Matt Damon impression. I'm from Cambridge. Here's my buddy Ben Affleck. And they're like, wait a second, aren't you supposed to be a guy who lives in Africa?
Yeah, they just replace Shep, the peanut loving pooch, with Ben Affleck.
What's a Ben Affleck catchphrase? Like, how you like damn apples is Matt Damon's catchphrase.
Yeah, I don't know, right? That he's got a catchphrase.
I think he does, right? Isn't his catchphrase like dunk? Something about dunking. He's like, I got to get my dunkin or something.
You got to get my dunks?
I got to get my dunks. That's his catchphrase, I think. Well, on that note, thanks for listening, everyone. We have The Mummy and The Mummy Returns coming up next. You can find us at CowsPod on Twitter. We are at cowspod.wordpress.com for web-related stuff. Mummy again, as I said, Mummy coming up next. And that will conclude the Fraser Sons. Mm-hmm. We're only doing three on this, and then it's off to other things. And but hopefully, you know, when the new Brendan Fraser movie comes out, when the new Scorsese/Fraser movie, we're going to call it a new Brendan Fraser movie.
Yeah.
Yeah. Who even knows who Brendan
also
Scorsese is?
Also, see No Sudden Move.
No Sudden Move. Although Brendan Fraser's part in that is like...
It's small.
Not... Yeah.
It's small, like, but he's
not
there.
Not a standout. But yeah, I'm excited for whatever the new Scorsese movie is, and so maybe we'll talk about that. We're going to try to do some new releases coming up, just a heads up. I mean, obviously, okay, we're going to do Dune because, for obvious reasons, if you don't know about my obsession with Dune, then you have not listened to enough of this podcast. Go back and listen to episodes because I bring it up every other episode. You might think I'm obsessed with Tenet. Okay, that's fine. That's fair. But I'm actually obsessed with Dune. So Dune 2021 we're doing, and it's going to get intense. It's going to be intense. So look forward to that in whatever, you know, a couple months. And then, I want to do some more new releases. I think it'll be fun.
Okay.
I'm just looking over at Laura, like, do you want to end?
Yeah, wrap this shit up, okay, man.
Can you play me off with a little keyboard cat?
No, I'm going to play you off with the bongos.
Bongogram. What could it mean?